Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Try and sum up some of the main themes of the discussion over the weeks on geopolitics, and also separately but linked to that, look at some of the issues of today. And I mentioned some of the issues of today because, of course, there is no one geopolitical agenda, however geopolitics is defined. There is no one language of geopolitics. Many people who write about geopolitics and comment upon it do so in the fond assumption, i.e. total naivety and utter ignorance, that the language that they're using, the understanding that they're using, is equally pertinent in, shall we say, Madagascar, or for that matter, China, or for that matter, Paraguay. The fact of the matter is, it's not only that individual states and individual groups within states have what we might call strategic geographies, and we can discuss what that means, but also, of course, their very assumptions about anything that we might call geopolitics varies, and not least in terms of two of the major theoretical and empirical points we've made continually, namely that there is a difference between geopolitics as descriptive and as, in a word, rhetorical. And when being used as descriptive, there is then a, as it were, additional distinction between the idea of geopolitics as something that automatically pertains. You are this country, you have this, these resources, you have this propinquity to other zones, therefore X follows. And the argument that in the contrast, there is no such automatic assumption, and instead there are the possibilities that differing conclusions can be drawn. And in both of these terms, there is, as a separate theoretical and empirical point, the issue of politics. Now, politics can either be construed, and these are not either-ors, they're obviously on a continuum, though again, the ignorant in analysis don't tend to allow for that. They can either be construed in terms of differing assumptions about politics, of geopolitics, in a sense in which there's no automatic reading from physical or human geography, or they can be assumed in the sense that there should be such an automatic reading, but because of false consciousness of some type or other, whether of right, left, centre, whether used in terms like pejorative terms, judgmental terms such as aggressive or appeasing, that there has been a failure to grasp what the situation should be. Now, shall we just say, those sentences, if thought about, as I hope you at least are interested in, otherwise you wouldn't be listening, if thought about, blow the whole subject up. They blow up all the standard literature on it. They blow up all the literature on geography leads to this or that or the other. And they actually instead put an enormous number of question marks around the place, which is as it should be, because human beings do not live like some predictable machine, nor are we some predictable machine as part of a broader pattern operating by some hidden hand, however construed and however defined, whether also to be brought into, as it were, awareness by some understanding or assessment of what everyone means by AI. Instead of which, there are multiple factors, they interact in unpredictable fashions, and there are contexts which have to be perceived, and those contexts themselves can be perceived differently. Again, etc., etc., etc. Again, all blowing up the subject as classically presented. One might then ask, before we get on and talk about the present, or maybe even get time to talk about the future. I think Graham's going to handle the future because actually the critic has a grade one crystal ball and he can do that. I'm afraid I'm simply a man of pewter and have no such facilities. But anyway, one might well then ask, why is it that intelligent people have suggested otherwise? That if intelligent people have written that such and such describes the geopolitics and have used geopolitics as a way that makes a course of action appear obvious, appear to provide continuity of explanation, and appears to provide clarity to the future. But the answer is, first of all, they're not that bright. Many of the people that use language, many of the people that are commentators, many of the people that are academics are not inherently bright. They're just very good at rhetoric. They're very good at arguing a case which may, in fact, be rather stupid. And I'm afraid geopolitics classically seems to attract those figures, particularly in the fields of international relations, whether understood within political science departments itself, I'm afraid to say, a bit of a misnomer or a linking of two things that possibly should not be seen together. Although, of course, science has its politics, but politics rarely has its science. And secondly, the same, I'm afraid, in history departments, though in history departments, people very rarely get to articulate their theory in any such fashion, which is just as well, because when they do, as you see in some branches of history, it generally shows up a sort of baleful analysis of past, present, and suggestions about the future. So do not feel that in putting question marks about the subject, we are in some way behaving in an outrageous fashion. What we are being is what my general role is when I look at concepts, which is being the little child, like my grandchildren, who ask about the emperor's clothes, because the emperor can clothe themselves, they can make each other and their chums and the mirror fellows of the British Academy or the other equivalents, but they're still no bloody good. And one needs to be aware of these factors when one looks at how so many phrases, so many subjects, we've already discussed it in the terms of strategy, for example, as if there's some automatic strategy that should flow from a situation, how so often it's an attempt to deny or at least diminish the inherently perceptual and political character by which people understand their interests, their identities, and their way in which they might respond to a crisis, and in doing so use the language of should in order to valorize their own choices and to diminish or criticize those of others. Period. That is enough on the general theory. I hope you can see, and if you can't see it by listening to this particular thing, you ought to go back and think about what we've discussed in previous episodes, and you might benefit, if you're open-minded, from reading my works on geopolitics. Let us instead look at the present. At the present moment, the geopolitics that most attracts attention is, on the one hand, the specific crisis in Ukraine and its wider manifestations and possible manifestations, two, the same in terms of the crisis over Gaza, and three, the same in terms of China and Taiwan. All of those are indeed important, and I will try and say a few words about them. It has to be said that in the mass that has been published, it is difficult to be original, though it is reasonable to be pertinent and to point out that many of the observations simply repeat each other. What is, I think, more significant if one's looking at geopolitics at the present moment is how far the concentration on rivalry between states and the wider permutations that this might lead to diminishes the number of conflicts, the number of other close to conflicts, in which it has to be said that the geopolitics, however defined, is that within states. So shall we say, for example, the much higher level at the present moment of conflict within Myanmar, Burma, than was the case, say, 5 years ago, or the extent to which earlier this year there was a flare-up in the fighting between the Ethiopian government and that of the Tigray movement within Ethiopia. So that latter aspect of geopolitics, and we can see the same if we were going to look at Sudan or Niger or Mali and many other states, is the type of geopolitics that tends to be underrated, and indeed the type of military history, the type of international relations, because often struggles within polities themselves have international consequences, those tend to be underrated. They may or may not, in some cases, be more significant in the long term. It may be the case that if you think about it, Sudan, which is a very large country, may in fact, in the long term, be more significant for the stability of the wider region than some of the other issues we are more prone to talk about. What I would suggest in these cases is that although there is one respect in which you could argue that the underlying, if you wish to take geographical perspective, is that of resource crisis, rising population, pressing on limited agricultural and space and water resources, and on top of that, international powers, should we say China, Russia, the United States, being concerned about raw material and resources, whether it's lithium or gold, whether it's oil, diamonds, coal, etc. In practical terms, there is no such direct reading. After all, there are other states in which you could argue that there is rising population causing a crisis, and on top of that, raw materials, but without the same level of instability or civil warfare. Zambia would be an example. And I think here one should rather draw attention to the political unpredictability rather than some sort of inevitability located in human and physical geography, particularly environmental pressure and rising population. And the political issues one should draw attention to are the particular problems of grounding and developing practices of the peaceful transfer of power, the peaceful pursuit of group interest, and the use of what we might call a politics that is removed from the bullet and is closer to the ballot box. And one can see a high level of instability in a number of areas, number of countries. The Sahel Belt of Africa is a classic example, in which a key element here are repeated crises of political coherence, accountability, and indeed, as in Gabon recently, succession. So those are problems. They require thinking about, they require discussion if we are going to talk about geopolitics, but alas, the classic geopolitics doesn't bother with them. And indeed, this is a long-established pattern. You can look back at the famous geopolitical theorists who were often completely oblivious to the nature of politics within states in the periods about which they were writing. Instead of which, one has the focus on struggles between states or political alignment. So at the present moment, Ukraine and Russia, China and Taiwan, with the possibility of seeing the United States trying to act as a deterrent to China, Israel and its Iranian-backed terrorist groups on its neighboring it, Hamas and Hezbollah, but as part also of a wider crisis in Southwest Asia. Now, each of these have commonalities, obviously, but also differences. And again, the commonality which is striking is the difficulty of finding any way short of violence, force, intimidation, coercion, or terrorism in order to pursue international differences or interests. And of course, in part, it's because you're dealing with what one might call messianic groups or tendencies who do not wish for any compromise. I mean, it's all very well saying to the Israelis they should or shouldn't have a ceasefire with Hamas, but the whole postulate upon which Hamas is based is not that of a peaceful coexistence at all. And again, you might or might not feel in a classic European social welfareist fashion that if you doshed out a few more benefits around the place, that would help to produce the situation that was more amenable. Actually, that's naive. This is an ideological and political struggle primarily, in which these groups are not particularly interested in, shall we say, achieving a better standard of living for the people they claim to represent. What they wish to do is destroy those they perceive as their opponent. You might argue, I would argue, that the same is true of President Putin of Russia. He has absolutely no idea and interest in what one might regard as democratic consent, To him, Ukraine is an abhorrent political existence, that it ought to be part of the Russian bloc. And he, and indeed China, have made it quite clear that there is a value system at stake here, and that the values that, as it were, are widely held within the West, though possibly less than they should be and than they used to be, values of free expression, of democratic accountability, of constitutional structures, of a rule of law in which the state does not direct, all of those are, to put it mildly, in abeyance or absent in these states, and indeed in their allies or aligned powers such as Iran or North Korea. Indeed, if you are feeling bored or in need of a joke this winter, read the constitutions of these countries and compare them to the reality. They are farcical. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not problems and issues in the West. Of course there are. One would be fools not to be aware of that. But there is a substantive difference that, for a kickoff, I'm able to sit here and make my comments without having a secret policeman keeping an eye on me, or at least a British secret policeman keeping an eye on me. So one needs to be aware that there is a reality of differing values that, in a sense, cannot be reduced to some sort of explanatory model of either physical geography or human geography or both. Indeed, the notion of geopolitics from that point of view is fundamentally flawed, because it proposes a relationship which is actually quite tenuous. I've already mentioned from that point of view the contrast between, shall we say, North Korea and South Korea. One might, in fact, go back and say exactly the same about the relationship in, shall we say, the American Civil War between the Confederacy and the Union. Two very different societies, but in many senses having a lot in common in terms of their elements, at least of their economic, physical, and human geography. Now, that doesn't necessarily help us too much, you might say, if what you're expecting from me is some sort of band-aid in which one can discuss how one can address the particular crises of the present day. Well, let's start with a simple one, a conflict that hasn't happened yet and which we hope won't happen yet, and that is China versus the United States over Taiwan. There are clearly elements of geography there. One would be an idiot to ignore those. There's propinquity, closeness, in the case of China and Taiwan, though closeness does not dictate any particular necessary relationship, as you can see, between Finland and Russia, for example, or indeed between not just South Korea and North Korea, but Japan and North Korea. Secondly, you can look at the geography, one that is increasingly rolled out, of the range of missiles, which is rolled out now when discussing not just Chinese threats, for example, in short range and in tactical and operational terms, threats to deny nearby waters to American fleets, but also the awareness that North Korean missiles now have apparently the capacity to deliver nuclear warheads against American targets on the mainland, continental mainland of the United States. And clearly that, again, has a geographical element, but it doesn't determine what the political choice would be on the part of either what we might call the aggressor power, North Korea, China, and what we might call the respondent power, in the case of America. And we can see this if we look at an analog in the discussion about the crises in Ukraine and the crises in Gaza. President Putin had the choice. There was no inevitability or necessity for him to launch his offensive. He was already in control of Crimea and much of the Donbass. He had the choice as to whether or not he attacked Kiev, just as Hamas didn't have to attack the neighboring Israeli settlements. And indeed, in response, it's worth pointing out that the Ukrainians had the choice in how to respond. They could have surrendered, they could have sought negotiations, though I think they would have found it very difficult to negotiate with President Putin. They could seek negotiations now, though again, I think they would find it very difficult to negotiate with him. And the Israelis had the choice as well. Though again, you might well feel, I would agree with you, that Israeli choices were constrained because to allow Hamas to launch such attacks and then to do nothing about it would itself have been sending probably a green light to follow for further attacks and further atrocities. But clearly, what one has got in every stage in what we are discussing is the element of choice. And this element of choice is one that, in my view, means that we should put the emphasis on politics. And of course, those of you who've listened to our earlier discussions when we did a series on strategy will know that that was exactly my theme. And if you haven't listened to them, I would urge you to do so, because it's even more pertinent in the present world than it was when we were discussing that a little while ago. So where do we go from there? Well, the next stage is, if politics is pertinent, politics itself is multifaceted. Politics involves, shall we say, what one might call closed doors politics, in which people seek to pursue solutions in what they perceive of as an analytical fashion, and to do so without being in the full gaze of public attention. One would be naive to think that that did not involve partisan, party, political advantage considerations, but that does not mean that those considerations simply define the process of analysis. That's number one. And number two, of course, we have the more public spheres of discussion, which in Britain, for example, is everything from Parliament to public meetings to the press to social media. Now, if one is thinking about those, then geopolitics is a convenient language. You can drop it into the conversation. You don't need to define it, because very few people actually ever go to the have the gumption to say, well, what do you mean by that? And when somebody says something particularly facile, which is most of the discussion, to say, well, that's a pretty meaningless phrase, isn't it? Or how does that provide an analytical explanation? And the same, of course, is when people talk about in terms of strategic. I mean, you know, strategic in one sense has been so misused and extended, for example, in Lawrence Friedman's book on strategy. It means the sort of, as it were, approach somebody might use in going to a social gathering in order to seek emotional or sexual favors from somebody else. That appears to be an equal use of strategy in his terms to, as it were, discussing how to pursue military or other advantage. So I think what one has got to accept is the rhetorical usage of terms such as strategy or geopolitics or balance of payments or social welfare, whatever, fairness, equality, democracy, freedom, or socialism, all of these terms are in some respects rhetorically valuable precisely because they are plastic. Precisely because they can be pushed in different directions, that because they lack a hard precision. That, I think, is a very important way of arguing the case if one wants to look at geopolitics. That, in other words, one should consider it, if we're looking at it in the Anglo-American context, we should begin it with the navalism associated with Mahan and Roosevelt, or the imperialism, the expansive imperialism, but also imperialism of a sense of being under threat, which we associate with Mackinder and the liberal unionists, and then take it forward from those very political and rhetorical contexts. And in that point of view, you know, you have your master geopoliticians being those politicians who are able to use the ideas of suggesting that there is an inevitability about what they propound. People like Winston Churchill or Margaret Thatcher would be classic examples to consider, who may in a sense be, I would argue were in a sense very clearly, far more important geopoliticians than those that we tend to think about. And I would suggest to you that that is a way to consider the subject, that a man like Henry Kissinger was only consequential because he held government office, not because he was a commentator or indeed had been a professor. Indeed, you might well say the same of myself. My views are of zero consequence, in fact, are extremely unlikely to have any resonance because people do not want to hear, as it were, somebody who poses questions against the way in which they are happy and conveniently to analyse the situation. The critics of the glib never do well. And this is not a podcast for the glib. You can go and listen to some other more well-known podcasts if you wish to follow that. Now, what else can we say about the particular crises of the present day? Well, several points come to mind. First of all, this shouldn't surprise us, that there are historical analogies which are not necessarily determined by a commonality of geographical circumstance. Let me unpick that. If you think, for example, about the Ukraine crisis, in which so far, and things may change, so far the Russians did badly initially and have done better subsequently. That is very similar to the Winter War of 1939-1940 between the Soviet Union and Finland. And that is not because the geography was the same. I mean, Winter War, good clue. I mean, the Russians did not attack last year in the winter, very different circumstances, but because it asks questions about and poses issues about a classic, I would argue, of military factors, which is the action-reaction cycle and also the way in which advantages, gaps and advantages are eroded, and also the difference between the offensive and the defensive. Those cannot be summarized in terms of some simple geopolitical adage. China and Taiwan. Well, China and Taiwan so far is an instance of a local crisis in which China, to a certain extent, is able to restrain Taiwan because of Taiwan's fears and anxieties, but also because Taiwan's master power, if you like, or shall we just say ally, itself is willing to play a restrained role. But conversely, there is an underlying instability caused not by some geography, not by some continental drift in which Taiwan is moving closer to China, but rather by the particular exigencies of the Xi regime in China, which both push it towards action, a desire to deliver success, Xi getting older, economic advantage, the strength of the military, growing strength of the military, but also disadvantage, economic difficulties, and also anxiety if things go wrong. This does not mean that one is more or less inevitable, and that should be a warning against those people who propound some simple geopolitical explanation of, as in, this flows from geography, rather like those facile and stupid books by Mr. Marshall. Next, one can actually look at possibly the one that is causing most interest at the present moment, in recent weeks, which is the crisis in Gaza. Again, it is in no way clear which direction that would, should, might, could go as a result of geographical propinquity. At the moment, although Israel has masking forces elsewhere, particularly against Hezbollah, but also in the West Bank, nevertheless, the Israelis are essentially fighting a one-front war, which gives them particular advantages, although albeit in a time sequence in which they can only probably keep their very large reserve army under arms for a limited period of time, whatever that period of time is, and they will have their own understandings of that, because it needs to be remembered that conflict takes place in a time-space politics nexus, not just simply a geopolitical one. So Israel has those advantages. Whether those advantages can be maintained is another question. Now, clearly, there has been a lot of international pressure on Israel. So far, that does not appear to be having an effect, no more than it should do, because after all, as far as the Israeli government is concerned, they're fighting a war for survival, albeit a war that at the moment they have the opportunity to attack on. But clearly, the situation might well change if they were also fighting on another front as well. And again, that's not inevitable. It doesn't flow from the geography. It flows from political choices. And I use the term flow, which suggests a naturalness, indeed a geographical choice of word. But in fact, of course, these aren't flows, nor are they machine things in which there is some switch and we move from one stage to another with a scientific precision. Instead of which, human beings are muddled, inchoate, confused, frightened, overeager, nervous, angry, a whole range of emotions and factors that affect their decision making. And at the same time, they are trying to use reason and rhetoric in order to analyze and explain what they are doing. In that lays what we call geopolitics, but geopolitics is not an adequate explanation, nor is it a particularly convincing rhetoric for that situation. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I mean, one of the key words that comes out of this podcast and also previous ones in the series is choices. What occurs to me listening to you is one can pull off various geopolitical strategies as if pulling them out of a drawer, as and when opportunities or disasters unfold and present themselves as the options to implement. But what happens when two or more geopolitical events happen at the same time? I mean, we had it back in 1956, we had the Suez Crisis and the communist crackdown in the Russian invasion of Hungary in 1956, at almost the same time. We might have had a Chinese invasion of Taiwan at the same time as the Russian invasion of Ukraine. To what extent do geopolitical thinkers accept that not all choices are equally actionable at the same time? Priorities have to take place, and sometimes different events with geopolitical considerations crash into one another at the same time, and priorities have to be made.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And what I would argue is that it leads to questions of prioritization. And prioritization is, as you may know from my work on strategy, my argument is the central issue in strategy, that I would argue it's true both in terms of what we would understand conventionally as military strategy, the allocation of resources between fronts, the determination where or where not to pursue offensives, but also in terms of the political strategies underlying, shall we say, alliance dynamics, debates with the home front, etc., etc. So I would say that if you, as you rather nicely put it, collide, often they pass in the night crises. They don't, in fact, lead to the general broadening out. And 1956 is a good example. The United States took a role in Suez, but not an active role. And its role in Hungary was to do nothing. So often they don't broaden out. But it's certainly the case that major powers face a more difficult geopolitical environment, if we wish to use that term, strategic environment, if we wish to use that term. Sure, we can think of another term if we want to, context if we want to, because by the nature of things, they're pursuing several concerns at once, or might be pursuing several concerns at once. Now, it could be the case that you put much of your effort on one and you're able with a minimum of effort to run another one. So 1900 Britain is fighting the Boer War, a major struggle, but also is part of the international force involved in subjugating the Boxer Rising in China and relieving the Allied delegations. It's not, in other words, impossible to act in more than one crisis at the same moment. Partly there is, though, the question of the sophistication of the governmental system and the resilience of the political process. And some states, some governments are better at one rather than another. Now, if you take the United States in the 2000s, the Navy was war planning for conflict with China and making it quite apparent to those who they wished to speak to that they thought that the army was foolish and the government as a whole foolish to be focusing on Afghanistan and Iraq right through. And the Navy had its little planning group at Newport and it was pressing for naval procurement linked on confrontation with China. And eventually, of course, that provided the basis for the so-called pivot to Asia. So it's not impossible to run more than one commitment at once. But as you correctly say, this can become very difficult. And at the present moment, it's clearly very difficult in terms of supplying the munition demands of both Ukraine and whatever might be necessary in terms of military or political help that the Americans feel they need to expend on behalf of Israel.
Well, we're coming to the end of this important series on geopolitics. And I just want to ask a question. We're about 120 years, coming up to 120 years since Halford Mackinder delivered his famous lecture. The world that Mackinder knew at that time, obviously, you know, it had sea power. There was powered flight, but the potential of planes in war was still at the science fiction level. You know, no serious discussion of long range missiles or drones or any of the other factors or satellites, any of the other factors that come into play now. Geopolitics has obviously been shaped by all these technological developments, but I wonder whether essentially geopolitics itself is really where Mackinder saw it in 1904. Has it as a discipline been changed by events and by innovation and change, or actually it's, you know, the fundamental pillars are still holding up the temple in the same way as they were in the Edwardian age?
Well, that's very interesting. First of all, let's take it as a, you know, I by background was an academic. That doesn't mean that I think that academics monopolize knowledge. They certainly don't, which is just as well. But let's start off with the academic situation. First of all, as a discipline, in the sense of coherent argument and analysis, it is very poorly developed within the academic system. And it's very interesting, as I discussed in my book on geopolitics published by Indiana, there has been, as you may know, a development since the late 20th century of what's known as critical geopolitics, which is a sort of aggressively left-wing, anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-Western geopolitics, a sort of precursor of what one's seen more generally in the last 15 years. I don't think it's very helpful. I discuss why not. I think it's very foolish. So, you know, readers can read that, and if they agree, they agree, and if they don't agree, fine. As far as the next category, which is the wider, if you wish to use the term, commentariat, you know, the sort of people whose articles appear in, I don't know, you know, sort of the Telegraph or the Guardian, the Critic or the Economist, generally facile things written too quickly, and throwing around the term, as I've said, geopolitics like shrapnel. Those don't, as it were, reflect to a discipline. They're, again, rather limited pieces, rather poorly thought through, or maybe thought through as well as the authors can do. Now, if what you're asking about is, as it were, astute analyses of the international situation and of power distributions within and between states, clearly there are some institutions and some individuals that do that. They vary in their character. You will find some, but by no means all, of the specialist consultancies on international risk can produce some rather good advice on some matters. You will find some of the intelligence services of the world are capable of understanding a situation and thinking it through. Some, but by no means all, of sections of the diplomatic services of states can also do the same. But by the very nature of things, we're talking about elements that are not in the public domain. And I would have to say to you that I'm afraid that in the public domain, the quality of geopolitical discussion is often very poor. And I think that that contributes in a way to the failure to understand international crises and to have a mature and sensible public debate on prioritization, strategy, and other such matters.
Well, I hope at least that these series of podcasts on geopolitics have raised the tone of the discussion, or will play their part in raising the tone of the discussion. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed. A Merry Christmas to you, and a Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
Yes, can I add also my best wishes? And can I say to people, you know, there's a lot of bleakness out there. Actually, the best thing you can do is to make sure you obviously see friends and family, but to stay warm and snuggle up with a good book. And that will actually, I don't mean one of mine, I mean probably a good novel. But what I would say to people is that the long pleasure that people have had over the years in reading and taking their imagination forward through the minds of others and through the words of others is an enormous solace in these difficult days.
Well, amen to that. Jeremy, thank you very much indeed.